Well, thank you very much for joining us for our TechLaw 10 podcast this week, and probably one of the busiest weeks I can recall in technology law. I'm Jonathan Armstrong. I'm normally at the Duane Morris London office, but I'm temporarily speaking to you from Times Square, New York. And Eric, you're still where you should be.
I'm where I belong. I'm sitting by the dock of the bay. I'm in a high-rise in San Francisco. I'm your Duane Morris San Francisco half of Tech Law 10, your weekly podcast on internet law.
And this week, I guess the big news in the U.S. is the story this week from the U.S. Supreme Court that GPS tracking by law enforcement is illegal. Have I got that right? Can you expand on that, Eric?
Well, you've certainly boiled it down, and since we're covering several topics today, at least a couple, I'll try to be brief. But interestingly, our United States Supreme Court on Monday of this week, which I think was just yesterday, right? It's hard to keep track. It's so busy these days. In a unanimous decision, which is relatively rare to get all nine justices lining up, they ruled against the Obama administration and said that police cannot put a GPS device on a suspect's car to track his movements without a warrant, which is interesting on a number of levels. One, I mean, some of the justices have been fairly, have been viewed as fairly pro, law enforcement, but this obviously is not a step in the direction that law enforcement would like to see. But essentially, they ruled that by putting a GPS on a car of someone who's suspected of drug trafficking basically amounts to an unreasonable search and seizure. The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union here in this country, has ruled this an important victory for privacy. There's been, at least the ACLU has expressed worry that, you know, with all these advancing technologies, there's many different ways that the government can monitor the private lives of citizens and violate their privacy rights, and this is a step in the right direction to make sure that doesn't happen. And Justin Antonin Scalia, who authored the majority opinion, essentially said that putting a GPS device like this on a suspect's vehicle without telling him essentially amounts to a trespass or an improper intrusion that would have been considered a search by the original framers of our Constitution more than 200 years ago. I sort of sit here and think to myself, gee, what would the original framers of the Constitution have thought about GPS technology? I'm sure that was at the forefront of their mind as they were looking ahead and drafting the Constitution. But our Constitution actually is a living and breathing document, and it has to apply to changing technological situations. So that's what's happened here. Now, on your side of the pond, unless you have comments on that.
Let me comment on that first, because we don't have a written Constitution. The thing that is closest to a written Constitution for us is the Magna Carta, which you might have heard of. The Magna Carta was issued in 1215, by which I don't mean quarter past noon. And surprisingly, doesn't mention GPS and doesn't mention digital tracking at all. Insightful though the barons who drew up the charter were, but it seems to me to be quite interesting, really, because obviously we traditionally say that Europe has much more all-embracing privacy law than the U.S. And of course, we're expecting tomorrow some big announcements from the European Commission in that direction. But I just doubt whether courts in Europe would have reached the same conclusion on a constitutional basis. I mean, generally speaking, we say that law enforcement have the right to track people. And for example, we've had cases in the UK over parabolic microphones. So these are high-tech microphones that the police can target almost like a rifle and listen into people's conversations. And the judges in cases like that have said, well, actually, if the policeman was standing next to the person and could have heard, then augmenting the police inquiry by the use of a parabolic microphone isn't a fetter on privacy. And I wonder if they'd not have the same argument that effectively GPS is labor saving, in that the policeman could theoretically follow the car forever, but that would require resource, and in these times law enforcement is stretched. And I just wonder if we would have reached the same result. And as you say, we wanted to discuss two or three cases this week. I think the case where we might have reached the same result is probably the big technology case in the UK this week, the case of Theodora Dallas, who's a psychology lecturer, or was a psychology lecturer, who's just been convicted and sentenced to a jail term for contempt of court. Why? Because she sat on a jury and she decided to research some of the evidence in the trial. The judge had told the jurors not to go on the internet. There were three defendants involved in a trial of causing grievous bodily harm, so an assault type case. The trial had to be discharged and a retrial. And Dallas, who's, as I say, a university psychology lecturer, ran the defense that she didn't understand what the judge was saying if he did say, don't go on the internet, because for the first 19 years of her life, she had lived in Greece. And despite the fact that she was able to lecture on quite a technical subject in an English university, she said that her language skills weren't up to understanding a prohibition on using the internet. And I think it's an interesting case, not only for that. She's sentenced to 6 months in prison. She'll serve three. She'll be released on license for the balance. But I think it's interesting for two other reasons: the seniority of the people involved. Cases like this must be brought by the Attorney General, but the Attorney General himself, Dominic Grieve, seems to have been personally involved in this case throughout. And I was at a function not so long ago with Dominic Grieve to celebrate the close bond between the English legal system and the Indian legal system. I have never seen a man look as uncomfortable wearing a flowery garland, but equally, I think he was extremely uncomfortable about use of the internet by jurors. And interestingly, also, just as you sat and had an extended, the Supreme Court en banc, all of the Supreme Court sat and heard this case, we had more or less the same. We had three High Court judges, including the Lord Chief Justice, decide and Theodore Dallas's case and the penalty to be imposed on her. And I think probably both of these cases illustrate, don't they, that the senior judges and the senior law enforcement officials on both sides of the Atlantic are having to grapple with technology issues now. And it's amazing how judges are trying to upskill themselves very quickly in the world of technology law. Do you think that's right, Eric?
Well, they need to, and I think you're right. What I found interesting about this Theodora Dallas case is, we're struggling also with the issue of jurors having too much access to information outside of the courtroom pertaining to a particular case, but this woman was sentenced to jail. What we've been wrestling with is, how specific do you need to be in terms of admonishing jurors who are about to sit on a case as to what they can and cannot do? And traditionally, our judges will look at a potential jury pool and say, look, if you're called to serve as one of the jurors on this actual case, you are prohibited from learning anything outside the case besides the evidence that's brought in front of you by the lawyers in this courtroom. So to make sure that you only consider truly admissible evidence as deemed appropriate by me, the judge. Then the question is, well, how specific do they need to be? And judges are becoming more specific, and courts are developing certain rules about how they actually have to lay out. What that means is you cannot go on the internet, whether you're at home or on your handheld device during lunch breaks, et cetera. But then the question is, what are the consequences? If you have a situation where a juror has obtained outside information and it taints the trial will no longer be of effect and it'll have to be done over again, which is a tremendous waste of resources and thwarts the justice system. But then, are there real consequences? Should a juror really get in trouble? And how much trouble? I mean, should it actually include something like jail time? I will tell you this, I've tried a number of cases, and we actually, as we conduct what's called voir dire, when we're actually interviewing the prospective jurors, we ask them, do you actually know any of the parties? Do you know any of the circumstances of this case? And sometimes a juror will raise their hand. We have to then take them aside at a sidebar and ask, how do you know about this? And they might say, they actually did research. They, you know, this was a relatively well-known incident, and I researched it myself. Some of them do it just because it's habit. I mean, you know, all the information is at our fingertips now, and we do it all day long in so many different contexts, so there might not be ill will, but sometimes I think jurors or people don't actually want to serve on a jury because it's time-consuming and burdensome, so they purposely poison themselves, and then they're not picked to be on the jury. So there are a lot of issues swimming around. I think we're already at our limit.
Let me just say two quick things. First of all, I think speaking to that, the Lord Chief Justice has made it clear that custodial sentence will be the norm rather than an exception. He says misuse of the internet by a juror is always a most serious irregularity, and an effective custodial sentence is virtually inevitable. So I think that's chilling for any juror who wants to sit on a case and research the defendants. Just very quickly, the other thing that caught my eye here in New York, I don't know whether you've seen this story. It's a breaking news story at the moment. Internet entrepreneur was trying to stand for Congress. And as ever, almost like this Dallas case, there's some background searches have been done on the internet. And what's come up is a blog that allegedly he wrote designating March the 14th as a special day. And given that we hope to go out to a family audience, we'll be delicate on the details, Eric. But he said that wives were to make it a special day for their husband in various ways, and then cook the husband a steak afterwards, it seems. And various people have objected to his turn of phrase, including, probably rightly, a number of women's rights organizations. None of the anti-meat lobby as yet, I don't think, have complained. but I think it just goes to show, you know, side of the same coin, really, that you must be extremely careful about what you say on the internet, and there's always somebody watching. Whatever you do online, there's always somebody there watching these days.
Well,
and I guess that's probably about as much as we've got time for, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say, you threw out some pretty spicy bait there at the end, but given our time constraints, I guess I just have to say thank you ever so much, Mr. Armstrong, for joining me on this podcast. Thank you, our audience, for joining us as well. We're now at Tech Law 13 for today. We've strayed a little bit, but there was so much to tell you. Please continue to join us as we embark through 2012 on these types of endeavors. You can reach me at ejsinrod@duanemorris.com. Jonathan will give you his coordinates, and he'll close it out in a second. I will just say, as you know, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Jonathan, bring it home, and let's close it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for listening. Have a good day, y'all, as I'm saying now that I'm stateside. I'm JP Armstrong at duanemorris.com. We're always happy to hear from you. Thank you for listening. Bye now.
I got to say, they don't say y'all in New York. But anyway, thank you very much. You're in the United States, but you're not in y'all country.